Nicole hosts Easter every year. That's why she shops at BJ's Wholesale Club, stocking up on spiral ham, baked goods, fresh flowers, candy, and 5 dozen eggs.
I've got a lot of baskets to fill.
Nicole's not worried because she knows she can save big and get it all done in one trip.
It's like winning the Easter egg hunt.
When you save, everyone wins. Get a $15 digital coupon when you spend $150 in one transaction, now through April 5th. Visit BJ's.com/Easter coupon for details. BJ's, your Easter destination.
Nobody does it better than Regent Seven Seas Cruises. Enjoy all-inclusive, unrivaled luxury with unlimited shore excursions, indulgent cuisine, personalized service, and more aboard spacious all-suite ships. Visit rssc.com to experience the unrivaled.
This is the examination of the hidden human condition.
You're listening to the Hidden Killers Podcast.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi.
That indeed it is. We're going to take you down to the courtroom for a hearing that took place at the end of last week involving accused killer Brian Koberger. Hearing about the gag order that was issued in the Idaho student murders case, the family of Kaylee Gonzalez and a lot of media outlets fighting for the gag order in the interest of public information right now. Judge hearing the arguments and as of this moment has not made a ruling, but that is expected sometime very, very soon. Let's go to the courtroom right now to hear that full hearing, which took place on June 9th of 2023.
We are now on the record. This is State versus Brian Koberger, CR 2922805. We're here for a hearing on the Gonzalez family's motion to appeal, amend, and or clarify amended dissemination order that was filed back on February 3rd, was delayed because the media sought some relief from the Idaho Supreme Court. There was a delay to find out what the Supreme Court was going to determine. They did it. And this morning we have the state represented by Mr. Thompson and Mr. Rudley. Mr. Koberger is in the courtroom, represented by Ms. Taylor and Mr. Logsdon. And I believe there he is.
Let me sit back here, Your Honor.
And I believe some of the family is participating, observing on Zoom. So before we get into the arguments, I want to address the Gonzalez family. And all the families, really, didn't really have an opportunity to do this at the arraignment. My heart does go out to the families. And the loss to your children is devastating and horrific. I mean, there's no dispute about that. I also want to acknowledge and apologize because at the arraignment I did stumble over a couple of names, Kaylee's name and Zayman's name, and I want to explain that. I was up all night, really ill, probably food poisoning, and I was not at full potential, probably also some emotion and nerves as I read those names. And I'm sorry. So that's my apology for that. I know some people were concerned about that and wanted to address it. I also wanted to explain a procedure at the arraignment that apparently drawn from the media that that some people were confused when Mr. Koberger declined to enter a plea. And I just wanted to clear that up because I didn't really see any explanation about that in the media. That is Mr. Koberger's right. And under Rule 11A1 of the Idaho Criminal Rules, and this is a quote, if a defendant refuses to plead, the court must direct the entry of a plea of not guilty. That is not unusual. But reading the media, it seemed like somewhat mysterious. So I wanted to explain that, particularly to the media. It's a small issue, but it's somewhat, I think that I have an obligation, just as the media has an obligation, to help to educate the public about the processes that we are responsible to follow in the courtroom, and that's important for journalists. That's also important for the citizens. So, if you're curious about that, you can always find the criminal rules on the Idaho Supreme Court website, and it's very, very easy to read them and maybe get a better understanding. All right, so that's my speech for today. Mr. Gray, come on up. And
if you allow me just a minute or two to get sorted out here.
Take your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gray.
Can I proceed, Your Honor?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Gray.
First, Your Honor, we'd like to thank you for apologizing to the victim's family. I think it was an emotional day for them, and they appreciate your apology. I know that they took that part up. Thank you. I would first want to start with a procedural history of this non-dissemination order, if I could. On January 3rd, 2023, the Judge Marshall ordered submitted a non-dissemination order. And in that order, it applied to parties in the action, which would then the prosecution, the defense, and any agents, investigators involved in. After that non-dissemination order was issued, I reached out to the prosecutor's office to see if I could get Judge Marshall's email. For some reason, I don't know if they took it down, but I couldn't find it online. And they informed me that they were not privy to give me that information. Then on January 13th, there was a Zoom call that was requested by Judge Marshall. That Zoom call was requested at 1 o'clock on the 13th. I was received an email at 12:58 from Judge Marshall's clerk requesting a Zoom call to speak to all interested parties. The Zoom call occurred at 4 o'clock p.m. During that meeting, the judge reminded us, all the parties involved, it was the prosecution, it was the defense, it was myself, it was the attorneys for the victims' families, the attorneys for the witnesses, I believe were there as well, a number of attorneys, and reminded us that her non-dissemination order mirrored that of Idaho Rules of Professional Conduct 3.6. As part of that hearing, and I think it's details here, she talks about the rule applies to all lawyers participating in the Zoom meeting, the state and the defense and all attorneys for the witnesses. When she had that Zoom meeting, and I've requested the transcript from that Zoom meeting and haven't been able to receive it yet from Judge Marshall's court, so we could have a full transcript of what went on that day. But as part of that meeting, I had questioned Judge Marshall regarding the victim's family and whether or not they were allowed to speak to the media based on the fact that she had said all interested parties as well in the initial non-dissemination order. I didn't receive any clarification. I was just instructed to go back to Idaho Rules of Professional Conduct 3.6, as well as I was told, and this is in quotes from her Zoom release, take their duties in that most regard and conducting themselves and advising their clients. I took that as I should tell my clients to be quiet. She reiterated that again in the Zoom call by saying that I had ethical duties abstract above and the IFA rules of professional conduct for commentary of Rule 3.6. And she reminded me later that lawyers have a responsibility in giving advice to their clients. I disagreed with Judge Marshall on almost every point during that meeting. As well as, if I had known that we were going to be discussing the IHO rules of professional conduct in those in that issue, I would have prepared. But only having a three-hour notice to allow me, and not knowing what the subject of the meeting was going to be, didn't allow me to address those issues at that time. Now, after the non-dissemination order in January 3rd and then the January 13th, 2023 meeting, the judge amended the non-dissemination order on January 18th. And she basically repeated the same order, except for, she added, the attorneys for any interested party in this case, including attorneys representing witnesses, victims, or victims' families, as well as parties to the above entitled action. So you can see the difference is that the first one dealt with parties to the case. The second one went way over the top, addressing all attorneys that might be associated with the case or any attorneys that might have an interested party in this case. So that's where we are today. I filed the motion based on that additional language. Now, I'd like to get into some of the issues here. It's very clear that I am not a party to the case and the victims' families are not a party to the case. That's very clear through all of the case law, as well as...
Can I interrupt you?
Yes.
There's no dispute about that.
Okay, then I...
Your clients are not parties. The only parties of this case are the state and Mr. Kohler. That's clear in the case law with regard to any victims or victims' families. There are constitutional protections and statutory protections for victims and their families.
I would agree.
That's well established.
So let's get into the actual non-dissemination order itself, how it addresses to me personally as the attorney for the victim's family. This non-dissemination order, of all of the cases and all of the motions that were filed, and referencing every case that was listed in this case, none of them apply to a victim's attorney, an attorney representing the victims. The Idaho v. Tapp case was an attorney speaking about a judge who he was in front of. The Good case was a defense attorney that spoke to the media. The Mezabov case was a defense attorney and a prosecutor. The Morrissey case was a defense attorney and a press conference. Barner versus Delahunty was an attorney and a judge, all parties to the case. Cutler was a defense attorney, U.S. v. Cutler. Zao versus Slop was a defense attorney. Irwin versus Dowd were the prosecutor's actions and speaking to the media. Shepard v. Marshall, Maxwell, is a trial publicity regarding the prosecutor's actions prior to trial. None of those things apply to the victim's family or the victim's attorney in any way. Now, I do agree that the court has the power to control those that are parties to the case and that are involved in the case in some way. But we have to define that. What means involvement in the case? Part of that is that the judge referred to the Idaho Rules of Professional Conduct 3.6, trial publicity. She references that multiple times as the basis for her non-dissemination order in this case and how it might apply to me. If you'll read the first paragraph, a lawyer who participates or has participated in the investigation or litigation of a matter shall not make extrajudicial statements. That is not me. It never has been me. It can't be me, because I'm not involved in the litigation. She also says...
Can I ask a question about that? Because, I mean, I think the case law is quite clear that attorneys who are representing witnesses can be restricted to some degree. Partly because they have access to particular information that may not, should not be shared with the public. And if I'm recalling correctly, the state has suggested or has determined that your clients are witnesses, potentially. So that's kind of the issue right there. Go ahead.
As part of that is that, let's just make it clear, the victim's family has never been involved in this investigation, ever, from the get-go. When, after Mr. Koberger was indicted, we received no information about anything regarding the prosecution. Nothing. They wouldn't even tell us that a grand jury was being impaneled for Mr. Koberger. They told us that there was a grand jury that was being impaneled. And common sense, we figured it out, because he's the only guy in the county. But they wouldn't even relay that information. They haven't given us any information regarding the investigation of the case. But the most critical part of it is that the prosecution has never, ever interviewed the Gonzalez family. So how in the world would we ever be able to be witnesses in this case? And for what purpose would we be? If you're asking about for sentencing purposes, that's post-conviction. That's after he's been convicted on the case. Prior to trial, we're not any witnesses. And that falls into completely different statutes. That falls into the restitution statute. It falls into the victim statute. I just handled that matter in front of the Lori Vallow case, where the judge, I had a motion, the defense did not want the victim's family to appear. And so the judge had to make a determination whether they were immediate family, because it was their grandparents. Completely different statutes, because that was post-conviction. And that witnesses, those witnesses were allowed in the courtroom and were involved in the sentencing aspect of it. Okay? So we are in a very, very different factual situation here. I'm not asking as a witness to the case, they never ever told us in any way how we would be witnesses in this case, other than the conjecture that we may have potentially. That's not good enough to stop the free speech of the victim's family, as well as myself. The other thing is that if the victims can say whatever they want, you know, the free speech, and that's exempt, why would I not be allowed to say the same thing that they say?
My understanding is that your clients are not restricted in any way, never have been.
Well, and I'll give you an example.
Is that true?
That's right. Well, I agree now, because that's not the tone of the Zoom meeting.
We're not talking about the tone. I'm talking about the language of the order.
Yes, the language of the order now, because any interested parties, I ask for clarification, now I understand that they can say whatever they want. And that's correct. But here's the problem. If they said, we think the judge is crazy, would I advise them against that? Absolutely.
Thank you.
But if I went and said, my victim, the family asked, has said that they think the judge is crazy. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm repeating exactly what they said. Now, what comes into play is, for our purposes today, is what if I offer up my own opinion? Right? Well, then I'm already governed by the Idaho Rules of Professional Conduct.
And if I'm glad you're acknowledging that.
No, well, every attorney is, Your Honor. I mean, it's not.
Thank you.
Every attorney is. So, but every rule doesn't apply all the time. If I'm talking poorly about a judge, another rule might pop in. 8.3, I think, is what it is, or 8.1. If I'm saying other things that might affect things another way, then maybe the trial publicity. But the trial publicity, I don't even think applies to me in this anyway. Because if you look at it, it says it applies to a lawyer who is participating or is participating in the investigation or litigation of a matter shall not make extrajudicial statements. And it goes on, highlighted by Judge Marshall, then in paragraph 3. The rule sets forth a basic general prohibition about lawyers making statements that a lawyer knows or should know will have a substantial likelihood of materially prejudicing the adjudicated proceeding. And at the bottom of the paragraph, it says this. Rule only applies to lawyers who are or who have been involved in the investigation or litigation of cases and their associates. If I'm not a party to the case, I can't be involved in the investigation or the litigation of this case in any way. So I would argue that the trial publicity rule of professional conduct does not apply to me as well.
Help me understand what you think you can't say that you are even saying.
I have no idea. I have no idea what it is.
You've been on the media and you've had interviews. So I'm kind of wondering what how do you feel that you've been restrained in any way with this order?
I think you're not seeing what the point is. What the point is that the court has issued a non-dissemination order that restricts First Amendment rights, that is overly broad in almost every aspect of it. Anybody that's interested and they have an attorney, when an attorney who's walking down the street could offer up his opinion in any way, it also takes away from the idea, doesn't the court want victims' families to have representation, to guide them through the legal process? Wouldn't the court encourage that? That they could explain things, say, maybe advise them on what to say, what not to say? I mean, if you're taking my voice away, you're taking the voice away of everything. The other part of it is this, is that I'm absolutely blown away that the prosecution doesn't agree with me in this case. The reason being is that they are representing the victims, which in turn are the victims' families. And I have not seen a poorer line of communication in my 22 years of practicing than the prosecution's office and the Gonzalez family. And I think it stems from, initially, we were critical of the investigation. They wanted to find the person who did this. That's normal emotions. And then from that point on, it has been, we are the enemy. And that's how we feel in this. And so, me guiding them, and then trying to limit my voice and helping them out in some way, and then throwing out a random idea that they may be potential witnesses when they never ever interviewed them, in any way, it's just an attempt to shut the attorney up and shut the family up, is what it is. Because if I had come to you today and said, we've given 7 interviews, Your Honor, we may be witnesses in this case, we've done all of these things, it may be a different story. We haven't done anything. They haven't interviewed the entire family. So,
well, I don't know. I don't know what's in all the investigation, obviously, and a lot of us don't know and probably won't know until the trial.
Well,
let me just say this. I think one of the potential issues is this is potentially a death penalty case. Hasn't been noticed, but that is a potential. And the families of the victims certainly would be witnesses in that process of sentencing. That is not post-conviction, technically, is it?
If your goal is fair and impartial jury, right, that's the reason for the non-dissemination order. Well, after the conviction, that goes away.
Well, it's also confidence in the process. So I have that job. I have a job of protecting and preserving the First Amendment and also the Sixth Amendment. And there is some balancing there. That is why lawyers who have access to information that is not accessible by the public have particular restrictions. That's what this whole case is about. In this hearing is about.
And as an officer of the court, I can tell you we have zero access.
Okay, so you're saying that the prosecutor's office has not shared information with your client.
Regarding the facts of this case, no, they haven't.
All right.
How things occurred.
Everybody's going to have a chance to weigh in on this, and I just, you're helping me understand what the issues are, so thank you.
So that's really the issue here. I mean, this is an important ruling, because what you're doing is this has never happened before, ever has it happened before, that a judge, Judge Marshall, has tried to silence the attorneys for victims. Never has it happened that I'm aware of.
Would you feel more comfortable if there was a more concrete
description of what people could say and what they can't say?
I don't think you have the authority to, Your
Honor. Well, I think I do have the authority.
My argument is that
in fact, I know I have the authority to do that.
Well, and the authority would be through the attempt to have a fair and impartial jury, that you can control people that are involved in the case, correct?
That's part of it.
And we're not involved in the case.
Okay. That's hard to accept. But
we're not witnesses in the case. We're not involved in the investigation. We're not involved in the litigation. I can't file any motions. I can't subpoena anybody. I can't cross-examine witnesses. I can't do anything. So this idea that there's this loose idea that there may be, weighing that versus our freedom to speak, First Amendment, is...
We're talking about your speech.
That's right.
Not your client's speech.
But that is my speech. That is part of it, though.
Well, in your memorandum, you are suggesting that you also have an independent position, that you are representing yourself.
I do.
It's distinctive from your responsibility to your clients.
That's why the motion is for amending or clarification, because there's the clients that have the freedom to speak. There's me repeating what they have to say. If they said the judge, we thought the judge was crazy, and I said the judge was crazy, I can't be, it doesn't violate the non-dissemination order because I'm allowed to say that. And then there's my independent voice where I said, the judge is crazy, yeah, I think the judge is crazy. That goes into another layer, right? Where it would be, I would be, Idaho Rules of Professional Conduct would fall into play, and what I would be doing or what I couldn't do. Not the non-dissemination order, because we're not parties to the case. I'd be governed by the Idaho Rules of Professional Conduct if I made those statements, extradite those statements. And I may or may not fall under the trial publicity. I would argue that I don't, because I'm not a party to it. I'm not litigated it. I don't have any information on it. None of those things. So, really, that's where the authority for me, for my voice, would come from the Idaho Rules of Professional Conduct, if I did that. And if I made a statement that I thought didn't apply for trial publicity purposes, that would be an argument for another day. But it wouldn't be for you, for a contempt of court for me, because I'm not a party to the case and I'm not involved in the case in any way. I'm just repeating what my clients say, or I'm just saying my own individual opinion, which doesn't, by the way, makes it absolutely unduly prejudicial. Because what if a guy is on an Idaho bar member, is walking down the street, looks up, sees a television program where the Gonzalez family says, well, we thought the judge was crazy, right? And then all of a sudden, the media is outside, they interview him, they say, hey, you're an attorney here. What about the judge being crazy? Well, I've been in front of him three or four times, and I would agree with him. You're going to sanction him and contempt of court? You can't. Same as me, because I'm not a party to it. He's not a party to it. He might be governed by the Idaho Rules of Professional Conduct by commenting on you, Your Honor, but it wouldn't be because of the judge's non-dissemination order. So how can it not apply to him, but it can apply to me? It can't.
Well, the case law suggests that because you represent potential witnesses, that you have access to information that may not or should not be shared with the public. That's what the case law says.
And I would argue this, what potential witnesses are we, number one, and what access to information do we have? I think the defense has argued that we have some sort of access because I have, the clients can tell me whatever they want to tell me, right? Well, that's free speech. They can say whatever they want to me, and I can go off and say whatever I want that they said. Because it's free speech. It's the First Amendment. So you can't, I mean, this non-dissemination order is so broad, none of the case law applies to people that are outside of the defense or the prosecution. That's the point of it. That's the whole point of a non-dissemination order, because they have access to it. They have access to the information. Victims, attorneys, families do not. And the idea that we may or may not be a potential witness is enough for Your Honor? I just can't see that, especially when there's no history of them ever being a witness. And to tell you the truth, The day after they filed that notice, or the day before they filed the notice that we may be potential witnesses, we had just gotten out of a meeting with the prosecutor's office, discussing whatever we could discuss, like our concerns, because that's all we do is go in and talk about our concerns, and they tell us, we can't say anything. We'll get to it. When we walked up, nowhere in that meeting were we described as being witnesses in this case. But all of a sudden, the next day, they thought we might be, even though they'd never interviewed us. So they're throwing stuff in the air that is not justified, and the idea that he thinks maybe might is not enough to regulate my free speech in this as the attorney for the victim's family, because that's what we are. We're not attorney for witnesses. We're attorney for the victim's family. And if the court has any other questions, I'd be more than happy.
I understand your position. Thank you, Mr. Gray. So let me go to the state. I don't know if that's Mr. Thompson or Mr. Rattle.
Don't be me. Can I have one moment, Your Honor?
Certainly. Thank you.
If I may,
yes, you may.
Mr. Rudley is actually going to be arguing on motions themselves, but as attorneys, we have a duty of candor to the court. Mr. Gray has made representations to the court that at best are misleading and in many ways simply untrue. I need to correct them for the record. Because the media is here. I do not want the public to come away with the impression that improprieties have occurred. First, Mr. Gray, on behalf of his clients, has propounded a number of questions to our office and investigators. We have answered the ones that we can. We have not shared ones that we are concerned that Mr. Gray or his clients would make public and compromise the integrity of the investigation. For him to say that we provided more information is simply not true. Secondly, claims that law enforcement has not interviewed his clients and that somehow that is the investigator's fault. In fact, from the very beginning, the investigators have attempted to interview his clients and Mr. Gray has not permitted it. So just for the record, I want to make sure that's clear. Thank you, Your Honor.
If I can speak to that, Your Honor.
You'll be able to back in after you hear the other arguments.
Thank you.
Mr. Levin, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. In State v. Spencer, the Idaho Supreme Court noted that it is also the duty of the prosecutor to ensure the right to a fair and impartial trial. Under the dictates of Shepard v. Maxwell, the court has a duty to take affirmative steps to address the impacts that intense pretrial publicity can have on a case. As noted in Shepard, Nebraska Press Association versus Stewart and their progeny, an order like the one in this case is an appropriate measure for addressing that duty of the court. As Mr. Boston's experts have noted, attorneys often have information about a case that may not be appropriate for dissemination in the press. Additionally, attorneys carry a greater weight when appearing on television. For instance, what might be easier for the parties to address is a juror that says, I've seen coverage on the case, but I don't always trust what I've seen on TV, and I can set that aside. What's more difficult is a juror that says, I've seen attorneys for the prosecution, attorneys for the defense, or attorneys for the victims on television talking about a critical aspect of the case. In the matter of Gentile versus State Bar of Nevada, that case involved an attorney who held one press conference in 1991 after the indictment of his client. In this case, Mr. Gray's repeatedly received statements and been on television. At minimum, it's insincere to argue that he's feeling bound by the order when it's clearly not abided by. In Gentile, the court noted that the speech of attorneys is subject to less substantial, or it can be regulated by less substantial means. In this case, as we've shown by the affidavit we filed, the Gonsalves families are potential witnesses in a trial, or more specifically, at sentencing. The order in this case is not vague, overbroad, unduly restrictive, or not narrowly drawn. It precludes all extrajudicial statements of the attorneys in this case, attorneys for the witnesses, victims, law enforcement, and investigators. The order addresses, if the court were to apply strict scrutiny, the order addresses a substantial likelihood that pretrial publicity poses to the integrity of the judicial system, and is tailored to ensure that the rights to a fair trial are upheld. As we briefed in the case of Levine, the alternatives such as sequestration of the jury or changing a venue aren't going to mitigate the impacts of statements, extrajudicial statements in this case, and are unlikely to do so. Thus, the state contends that the order is an appropriate measure of the court to uphold its duty under Shepherd, Nebraska Press Association, and the like to preserve the right to a fair and impartial trial. At a minimum, Mr. Gray's statements that he's not bound by trial publicity rules or 3.6 in this case illustrate why the order of the court is necessary in this matter. And so we would ask that the court uphold the amended non-dissemination order, or at most tailor it to those statements specifically precluded in Rule of Professional Conduct 3.8. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Redley. Yeah, do you think that would be helpful to just, and I asked Mr. Gray this same question, would it be helpful to say, okay, you can say these things, but you can't say these things, and be more specific about that?
Your Honor, our initial position is that the total prohibition of extrajudicial statements is the safest and most responsive way in this case to address and preserve the right to a fair and impartial trial.
All right. Can you go back? You mentioned this about the standard particularly applying to the lawyers who are somehow connected with the case.
Yes, Your Honor. In Nebraska Press Association v. Stewart, it's noted that the I believe Justice Brennan states that there's no doubt that the court has authority, though it's in a footnote, it's no doubt that the court has authority to regulate the speech of attorneys, witnesses, and other participants in the court process. At this point, the evidence that's been provided is that the family would be potential witnesses in the case, as Mr. Thompson mentioned. We haven't necessarily been able to make a full assessment of that, but undoubtedly they'd be witnesses in any sentencing.
And what about the standard? Strict scrutiny or lower standard?
Your Honor, we would argue that the court should apply the standard in Gentile versus State Bar of Nevada, where the Supreme Court stated that, I don't want to mess this up too quick here, that the speech of lawyers may be regulated under a less demanding standard. So we would argue that so long as the court finds that it has a duty under Shepherd to preserve the right to a fair and impartial trial, that the order addresses the substantial likelihood that negative pretrial publicity would have on that right, then the court would have authority to impose the amended non-dissemination order.
Thank you, Mr. Rappin.
Thank you.
Judge, I think a lot has already been said, and obviously we wrote a lot in the briefing, so I guess I'll just touch on a couple of things. In terms of the argument that the victim's families are not involved in the litigation of this case and therefore don't fall under 3.6, it would be our position that if you have statutory and constitutional rights involved in this case, you're involved in the litigation. Regardless of whether or not the prosecution is willing to work closely with you or whatever issue you have there, the reality is that you have literal rights that permit you certain things that are involved in this case, you're involved in litigation. And therefore, you fall within 3.6 just like everyone else. Second, the standard from Gentile is the substantial likelihood of material prejudice. I don't want to get too much into that, Judge. I think that's kind of this afternoon's argument. I think the main thing before the court, as far as Mr. Gray and the family, is just do they fall within this, and then the court to decide what is appropriate. But I would note that given the vast amount of media coverage in this case, the fact that it seems like no matter what anybody says or does, in one way, shape, or form, it will be twisted into an attack on my client. We also agree that at this point, the safest thing to do is for everyone just not be talking to the media and allow statements to be made here where we all get a chance to speak and the media gets all that information. If they still choose to do what it is they've been doing, then that's on them. But we don't have somebody who's just trying to whip the media into a frenzy and send this case to the firing squad or however it is. So that's our main concern. The only other thing that I wanted to address, and the court addressed this a little bit, the reason we stand silent with grand jury indictments is because there's an old arcane rule that says that if you have a grand jury indictment and you enter a plea, you are accepting the validity of the indictment. I haven't seen prosecutors try to use that in a long time, but we can avoid any possible claims that somehow we can't challenge anything with the indictment by simply standing silent and having the court enter the plea. So just so that everybody's clear, that's why we do that. Does court have any questions for me?
I don't think so, but thank you for that additional education.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Gray, it's your motion, so you can respond to what other counsel expressed. Thank you.
I guess the first thing I would want to address is the prosecution's idea that I haven't allowed our clients to speak with the investigators. You'll realize that the date of the incident, I wasn't retained on this case until close to December 5th, which will be more than 3 weeks after the incident occurred, and they still have made no contact as far as interviewing the victim's families. So somehow that I precluded that in some way is just not true, Your Honor. And as far as scheduling those things, I'll just leave it at that. The second part is everyone is quoting the Gentile case. The Gentile case is exactly like all of the other cases. It says over and over, it has to be a lawyer participating in the judicial proceedings. It has to be a lawyer who represents a defendant involved with the criminal justice system, a lawyer actively participating in trial, a lawyer who's participating before the courts, can only be limited if he's participating in front of the courts. None of it applies to me.
It seems like you're in the court right now.
Because you're the one that brought me in here because of the non-dissemination.
You brought yourself.
Yeah, well.
You're the one who filed the motion.
I did file the motion because the non-dissemination order is unconstitutional.
I understand. I'm just trying to clarify what you just said.
Well, this will probably be the only time I'm allowed because I won't have the authority to file any other motions on anything else in this case.
Why would you say that?
Well, because I'm not a party to the case.
You can still, I mean, the media is not a party of the case either.
Once again,
the Supreme Court has said they have standing to come into the court and address issues, so.
Yeah, but that's completely separate. They're not.
Well, I know it's separate.
Okay, so.
I also respect your position in representing the families victim, the family's victim, excuse me, the victim's family, and I respect that. And there's a certain, there are some constitutional issues, rights that they have. So I'm not dismissing that.
And the mere fact that you have a right, I'm absolutely positive that the Idaho legislature and the Constitution, when they gave victims rights, didn't think that that was implementing those victims into the trial in some way. Absolutely positive that wasn't the intention of it.
Totally so, agree with that.
So this idea that if you have rights, then you're involved is just beyond. That being said, Your Honor, nothing precluded the prosecution from contacting my clients well before I was representing them. They had almost 3 weeks to contact them. Don't mark me on this. I think I was retained on December 5th. I think that was the day. I don't have my file in front of me, but it would hold me to it. But I think that was the day. So they had plenty of time to contact my clients and interview them if they were going to be potential witnesses in this case. And since then, every time we have had a meeting, we have initiated that conversation. It hasn't been the prosecution initiating that conversation.
So are you saying since you have been representing your clients that the prosecutor or investigators have not asked for interviews?
I would say this. In the meetings that I have had with the prosecution's office, I have asked, as part of that, whether interviewing my clients might be an issue. Would they like to do that in some way? I've offered that up in some way. And they've never taken us up on it. And maybe a random email here and there that says something and no follow-up whatsoever about any of it. So this idea that they are going to be witnesses in this case is just an attempt by the prosecution to shut them up as well as to shut me up. And by the way, people completely forget about this. All of the information that has been disseminated to the public from the get-go was the mayor, Art Bentley. Chief Fry had interviews. Bill Thompson had interviews. The coroner had interviews. All of those people had interviews. We didn't. We didn't until we started getting information and started trying to figure out what was going on. After they had given interview after interview after interview, that was the purpose of the judge issuing the non-dissemination order, is to quiet them up, not quiet the victims up. They had no control over that investigation from the get-go.
Well, that order was a stipulation between the state and Mr. Koberger.
That's the other thing, though, is that the court, after that Zoom meeting, Judge Marshall incorrectly said that that was stipulated by all parties. I never stipulated to that. I emailed the
You're
judge.
You're not a party.
Exactly right. I'm not involved in the case.
The stipulation was between the parties. So as you correctly stated who the parties are.
So we would ask.
I agree, but you were suggesting that it was entered to shut down the prosecutor's office.
Why would they?
That's what you just said.
I do think that part of the that was part of the process is that they understood that their investigation was getting out of hand. Too many people were talking in their investigation, and that's why they stipulated to it. Yes, I do.
Okay, when you say they, you mean the prosecutor?
Yes. Yes.
All right.
Do you want me to give you a final, or do you?
Go for it.
Okay.
Yeah. You go.
We're not a party to the case. You are very aware of that. I have the right to repeat what my clients say to the media. I also have an independent right that I'm governed by. The Idaho Rules of Professional Conduct regarding those individual rights versus my own opinions. But those opinions, I don't firmly believe, would fall under the publicity rule on the Idaho Rules of Professional Conduct because I'm not litigating it or part of the litigation. And the reason those things are in place are because people that have real privy information regarding the prosecution and the defense, which I don't, which my clients don't in any way, it should apply. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Green. All right. Well, I'm not going to issue a decision today. I'm going to issue a written decision. There is a lot of briefing and I heard some very interesting argument today, and I'll get that to work and try to get a decision out as soon as possible. So anything else we need to address before I adjourn? Mr. Thompson?
I don't think so, yeah.
Ms. Taylor?
Yeah, you know, we thought you'd probably want to issue an order and wait, but I guess we're just wondering if in the meantime, the order as it is remains in place.
Yes.
Thank you.
It remains in place until I address it. So, with that, we are adjourned.
This is an examination of the hidden human condition.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast.
The Hidden Killers Podcast.
With Tony Bruschi.
Of course, we are keeping you up to date on this case and so many more. If you'd like to follow any of our cases individually, you can do that through the True Crime Today Network. You can get it ad-free when you sign up through Apple Podcasts, or just go to our description of the episode. The list of our case channels are there for you right now. You can follow exclusive cases, including the Idaho murders, the case against Koberger. My name's Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.